campaigns like this keep us going, but going for what? Going so we can learn, going so we can pray, going so we can come together. So with that in mind, let's jump in. We are starting the book of Vayikra this week. The book of Vayikra, Eschata'ai Ani Mazkir, I will acknowledge my shortcomings, and that is that there's a rabbi trick, and that is that when we come to the book of Vayikra, we never talk about the Parsha. You know why? Because sacrifices and people with leprosy and hierarchies, they just don't do it. We like narratives. We like stories. And so, you know, I wrote something, you know, 2 years ago, actually, 2020, when we were at home during this time. And I felt there was like a personal lesson, for me at least, and that is as a rabbi, as someone who's supposed to be teaching the Parsha, and I felt like there was a personal lesson that, you know, we're supposed to be that I ignored Vayikra. You know, we spent most of the book of Vayikra at home. We didn't have shul, right? The shul closed March 2020, exactly 2 years ago, and it was closed for most of Vayikra. And it was, you know, I felt like it was a slap in the face. Like, it's because we ignored the book of Vayikra, so Vayikra kind of, so to speak, ignored us. So, when we reopened the doors, for those of you who are on Shabbos afternoon, we did a whole series on Vayikra. We went through chapter by chapter. I was like, you know what? That's my tshuva. We're going to go chapter by chapter. And we had a whole class. It was exciting for me because I never learned Vayikra properly. But we went through chapter by chapter by chapter until we finished the book of Vayikra. I was very excited about it. This class over here, we're doing the Parsha of the Week. So we're not going to go chapter by chapter, but I'm looking forward to spending this time going through parts of Vayikra together because it's one of the five books. You know, it's Torah. It's important. Even if these things don't speak to us, we have to figure out how they could and should speak to us. That's on us. It's not, you know, as Rav Hirsch used to say, or Rav Samson Raphael Hirsch used to say, you know, we don't change the Torah to meet up with us. We change ourselves to be able to match up to the Torah. That's what we strive for. So that's what we're going to do. So with that in mind, today we're going to take a bird's eye view of the main theme, or one of the main themes in the book of Vayikra, and that is karbanot, sacrifice. You know, one of my teachers, he was very dramatic. His name was Rav Mendel Blachman, and he used to push us to think, but he would do so in a very dramatic way. So he'd say, you know, we would be singing a song. Friday nights, he would give these long lectures. And we would be singing songs about, you know, the rebuilding of Yerushalayim, the rebuilding of the temple. And he'd stop us and he'd say, really? Really? You're looking forward to the temple being rebuilt? You want to see screaming cows and ox and walking around, blood on the floor. You know, the description in the Talmud is pretty graphic. You know, it's like they had like these drains because there was so much blood in a Pesach time. Yeah, exactly, right? Is this what you're looking forward to? You know, and it pushes us to think, like, what is the deal? You know, what's going on? Because it doesn't, for many of us, doesn't sit so well. So today, I want to spend some time understanding why where the institution of karbanos, sacrifice, comes from, what it's meant to represent, and share also some ideas from our sages about what sacrifices could possibly look like in the future. We know that right now, without a temple, we do not have sacrifices in the literal sense, but is there something to say about what's going to happen in the future? And we'll see some interesting opinions about that as well. So let's begin. Let's begin by discussing a very, very famous approach, oftentimes misunderstood approach, that of the Rambam, Maimonides. Okay, so you have a source sheet in front of you, Karbanos in the past and the future, and we're going to start at the first source, which is, it's taken from Ramban, Nachmanides, but he's quoting Maimonides, who's writing in his very famous book called Mor Nevuchim, The Guide to the Perplexed. I'm going to read it in Hebrew, but you have a translation underneath, immediately underneath the paragraph. So this is a quote of the Rambam, of Maimonides. Va'amar ha'rav b'mura ha'nevuchim. So the Rav, meaning the teacher, the master, he refers to Maimonides with great reverence. He wrote in Mor Nevuchim, again, the guide to the perplexed, Kitam ha'karbanos, the reason behind sacrifices, ba'avor shehamitzrim vehakastim, the Egyptians and the Castians, okay? Asher ha'yisrael garim b'socham, Garim v'toshvim ba'artzam me'olam, amongst which the Jews were living in their lands forever, meaning for all of time. The Jews were living among the Egyptians. For hundreds of years, they were living in Egypt, right? Before the giving of the Torah, for hundreds of years, the Jews are in Egypt. Before that, they are with the Canaanites, the Castians, all these other nations. Hayu ovdim lebakar ulitzon. these nations would bring offerings to cattle and to sheep. Ki amitzrim ovdim l'tela. We know, this is well known, one of the reasons that we sacrifice, there is this Paschal lamb, is one of the most famous reasons, is the reasons the Jews sacrificed a lamb in Egypt for the first Pesach Seder was as a, what we call in Yiddish, a shtach. It was basically a way of saying this to the Egyptians. The Egyptians would serve the sheep, that was their god, and the Jews said, we're taking your god and serving it to the real god. Okay? So they would serve the sheep. Ve'akastim ovdim l'shedim. And the Castians, one of the tribes, one of the influential tribes in the region, they would serve the goats, okay? Asher yiru lahem bedmus seirim. Sorry, they would serve these demons, which in mythology, they appeared, the demons would appear, the shadim appear as goats. Okay, that's their image, that's what they look like. Va'anche hodu, and to this day, people in Hodu, Adayom, to this day, lo yishchetu bakar la'olam. Never sacrifice cattle, right? We know the term, the expression is, well, there's a very famous expression that we use, which is a religious expression. Holy cow, right? If you've heard that, said that, right? It's actually, some people say you shouldn't say that. Because what the actual source for it is in Hodu, in India and those regions, cows are sacred, right? I'm sure you've seen like famous pictures of like, you know, people driving and then there's a cow that walks the street. Everyone stops. You don't drive, you don't maneuver around, you wait, right? Holy cow is a religious statement, right? They don't serve these things. Okay, so basically what he begins by stating is that in these regions, they would go ahead and serve cattle. They would serve goats. They would serve all different types of animals. Va'avur Cain, for that reason, tziva lishchot eile hashlosha minim l'shem anichbad. So God decreed that we slaughter these types of animals to Hashem, kidei sheyodea, so that people know, ki adavar shehoyu choshvim kemetachlis havera hu asher yakrivu lebore. The things which are the extreme of sinfulness, okay, we'll have to understand what he means in a moment, we bring them to God, uvo yiskapra avonos, and through that, the sins are forgiven. Ki ken yisrapu hamunos aros, shemadve hanefesh. This is how we heal all bad internal flaws that plague the soul. Ki kol madve v'chol choli lo yisrape, ki im behepcho. Because every single form of sickness is healed by its opposite. This is Maimonides' theory. It's actually not his theory. He takes this theory from Aristotle. Aristotle writes that the way you heal, let's say you have a characteristic flaw. Let's say you are a very impatient person, okay? So how do you heal? Impatience, okay, sometimes it's good. You have energy, you have ambition, it's wonderful. But we all know that it has an ugly side, right? How do we heal this impatience? Aristotle, and Maimonides codifies this, he says the way to do so is going to the opposite extreme for a while, and then eventually we go to what he calls the golden mean, we find some level in the middle. The idea is if we have one extreme, we push ourselves, we force ourselves to act in the opposite extreme for a while, and then once we're comfortable in the opposite extreme, then we go back to the middle. So says the Rambam, so what the Rambam seems to be saying over here is that since they were serving these animals, the way to heal ourselves from that is to go ahead and go to the opposite extreme. That's what Maimonides says. Now, I know there are different, you may have heard different ways of people framing Maimonides. People say it sometimes a little bit differently. People sometimes summarize, let me just summarize what we actually read, and then I'll tell you what other people sometimes say. Maimonides is suggesting the reason we have karbanos, the reason we have animal offerings, is since people were serving these animals, we want to show that it's all wrong. So we use these animals to serve God, right? Idolatry, keep in mind, in the ancient world, was front and center, everywhere, everywhere you went. Everyone's serving idols, everyone's serving animals, everyone's going ahead and doing these things. So we have to uproot this bad way of thinking. The way we do so is the animals, you're serving a sheep, you're serving a cow, guess what? I'm taking that cow, I'm taking that sheep, I'm taking that goat, and I'm bringing it to God. That way we eradicate this faulty form of thinking. Okay, that's what the Rambam says. There are those who understand this a little bit differently, and I struggle to see how they understand it over here. But that is, they understand that it wasn't, the part of this is somewhat of a concession to the way, to our inability to dramatically change ourselves. And what they mean is as follows. Some people understand what the Rambam is saying over here, is that to start serving God in this completely abstract fashion, God doesn't have an image. God doesn't, how do we connect to God? So since back in the day, everyone's using animal sacrifice, We're also going to use animal sacrifice, but we're going to bring it to God. That's one way some people understand Maimonides. I don't think that's what he's saying. But one way or another, Maimonides is clearly saying that the idea of sacrifice is because in the ancient world, people were serving these animals, things were going on. Yes?
So, if I remember correctly, does that mean that he also felt that the time of animal sacrifice was now over by the time it came to...
It's a good question. So he doesn't say that. This is okay. Quick soapbox / tangent, okay? The Rambam Maimonides, you know, he speaks about one of the reasons behind kosher, and we'll talk about this hopefully in later in Sefer Vayikra, is due to health reasons. Due to health reasons, you know, for example, he says, you know, pork, pigs, you know, cause trichinosis, right? Because they didn't clean it so well, and I don't know exactly, but basically, people who ate pork, it could cause illness. So Maimonides says, the reason that we eat certain foods and don't eat others is because of health reasons. So fast forward, nowadays, I don't know if you have any non-Jewish friends, they probably eat pork, and they're probably doing just fine. Maybe they're healthier than you, right? So the argument goes, forget it. You know, we don't need this kosher thing because we've figured out how to get past it. So here's the danger. You know, in the Torah, does it say a rationale behind these mitzvos? Torah says, thou shall do this, thou shall not do that. Okay, do this, don't do that. That's all it says. It doesn't in any way say why. Very rarely, like maybe 1%, less than 1% of the time, it says why you shouldn't do a mitzvah. Or you shouldn't do. 99% of the time, it says, do this, don't do that. So later on in history, different scholars came along and they said, you know, it's hard to just do if we don't get it. You know, if I just tell you to do something, then our natural reaction is, what are you telling me to do it? Oh, why? Right? And it becomes more meaningful to us also. When I have a reason, when I say the reason I keep Shabbos is because the whole week it's so frenetic and the whole week it's so insane and so chaotic. And for 25 hours, I get to just not have to deal with my phone and not have to deal with my business. And it's so amazing, right? So it makes Shabbos more meaningful. The danger, though, is that we start to think that the real reason, that this is the real reason, this is the complete reason we do it. And if the reason no longer exists, then the mitzvah no longer exists. But that's a mistake. Because God never said, you should do it because. Because if he did say that, then when the because no longer is true, then the mitzvah is no longer true. But that's not the way it works. God says, do this, don't do that. To make it more meaningful, scholars theorized in their era, maybe this is why, maybe this isn't why. But it's not fact. And therefore, if the reason no longer exists, we still do the mitzvah. Because God, who is transcends time, told us this is the right thing. We believe the Torah is timeless, transcends time. God transcends time. And therefore, whether the reason still stands, the reasons that are suggested still stand or not, the mitzvah still stands. You with me? Yeah? So to your point, I don't know. The Rambam doesn't say that. And he doesn't deal with, he never says the words, since nowadays, blah, 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 therefore they won't exist. We'll talk about some opinions later on. But the Rambam never writes anywhere that sacrifice won't exist nowadays. People theorize based on this reason it won't exist. I have a hard time believing the Rambam would say that. All of his reasons, any thoughtful person, you know, recognizes that any reason is going to be limited to, but the Rambam nowhere in his writings, as far as I know, never writes, when the reason that I'm theorizing on my own no longer exists, the mitzvah no longer exists. That would be beyond arrogant and just simply inaccurate. Okay, so the Rambam's theory is clearly, though, that sacrifice is a response to the world around the Jewish people as a way of helping them modify their thoughts, etc. The challenge to this is what? The challenge to this is, there's a couple of challenges. One of the most, when's the first time sacrifices are mentioned in the Torah? Even before, Cain and Abel is one of the times, good, by Cain and Abel, right? No. Sorry? So Cain and Abel is one of the times. It says that Abel brought an animal offering, and what does it say? God accepted it, right? And later on in the times of Noah, right? Now, when Cain and Abel are around, how many other people are around in the world? From the biblical accounts? Nobody. Right? Noah, fast forward a little while, right? Noah comes off the ark. How many idolaters are on the earth at that point? Nobody. Nobody's around, right? They're all just died, right? And so Noah comes along, and what is the first thing that he does? He brings offerings, and the Torah says, L'reach nichoach, it has this, whatever this means, some pleasant smell to God, meaning God accepts it, God appreciates it. So Nachmanides and others ask on this approach of the Rambam, what's going on over here? right? It doesn't make sense. If you're telling me the whole goal of the whole reason we have sacrifice is it's a response to the culture of the time, then why do we have sacrifice predating the culture of the time, predating the Egyptians? The Egyptians didn't exist at that point. The Chaldeans didn't exist at that point. And yet people are bringing offerings and the Torah is saying they're accepted. It's challenging, right? That's the biggest question they have. And it's a pretty powerful question. So one, right, you're with me? In other words, this is a real challenge on Maimonides' approach. So one possible answer, I'll just mention one, there's more here on this page, but one possible answer, Abarbanel, Don Isaac Abarbanel, right, 15th century and 16th century Spanish philosopher and scholar, suggests that what Maimonides means is as follows. He's saying that of course there's value in sacrifice. Of course there's something there. But there's also a certain danger, perhaps, in using animals in serving God. And there's something also lacking that we need physical items to serve God. If it wouldn't be for the cultural milieu, for what's going on in the civilization at that time, then theoretically God would have said, prayer would suffice. Prayer would suffice. But coupled to, right? In other words, like this, sacrifice does serve a purpose, right? But maybe God wouldn't have instituted sacrifice. And the only reason that he did, and instead we'd have served him in other ways, like we do right now, like we pray and we do mitzvahs and we talk to God and all these other ways. But in addition to the fact that there's some intrinsic value, there were things going on in the cultures around them, and they had to be negated. And therefore, God instituted karbanos. Do you hear the difference? In other words, Maimonides is not suggesting that karbanos are only valuable as a counter to the faulty thinking of the civilization of the cultures around them. He's saying, no, of course there's intrinsic value in it. But the reason God instituted it, in other words, let me say like this. Is there value? Someone asked me a question the other day, an ethical question. They ordered something from a company, okay? And this happens all the time nowadays, right? You order something from Amazon or whatever, and they send you like two things instead of one, right? Do you have to send it back? Okay? So, yeah? Yeah, strictly speaking, you do not. And that's why I told them, strictly speaking, it's on them. Strictly speaking, it's on them. And I said, but, there's a moral requirement, not requirement, I said there'd be a value in doing some effort to return it. I said, I agree. For you to go, it's hard, it's annoying to do returns, okay? So I said, you should send them an email saying, hey, you send me an extra thing. If you want to send me like a return postage, I'll be happy to send it back, right? So, again, there's two levels. There's what's absolutely required. So again, halacha is one level, okay? And then there's some added level as well. Okay, I apologize, heads up, just to let you know. There's a video for this campaign and there's our videographer, Shlomo, who's here. So just act casual. But you might be on a video just for a few seconds, don't worry. Okay, just wanted to give you a heads up on that. The bottom line is that's what the Rambam perhaps is saying. Of course there's value, just like there's value in sending that email to the company saying you got the extra thing. But the fact that there's value isn't enough to make it a law. Why? So in other words, karbanos, there's a value in karbanos, as we see from Noah, from Abel, right? We see there's value. But in order to make it a law, God only did that because of what was going on in the culture of the time. That's one way of addressing this question, right? You hear? You understand? You hear the analogy? Okay, fine. That's Maimonides' approach, the Rambam's approach. Not everyone accepts that approach, but it's an approach that's worth thinking about. The Ramban Nachman. If you look at the second source on the page under Ramban Vayikra, chapter 1, verse 9, here the Ramban Nachmanides suggests a different idea. V'yoser ra'oi lishmoa hatam sha'omrim bahem. It is more appropriate, he says, to listen to the following reason that's given. Ki ba'avur shemaseh b'nei Adam. Anything we do takes place as a couple of steps. There's a thought. Oftentimes we'll express verbally what we're doing, and then we'll actually do it, right? It impacts our thought, it impacts our words, and we do, right? Usually these are all the different faculties that we engage whenever we do something. So tziva Hashem, so God commanded, ki kasher yechata, when we sin, yavi karban. You should bring a sacrifice. In other words, when we sin, think about your favorite sin. Something you did last, I don't know, just kidding. Don't know if we shouldn't have a favorite sin, but something you've done, something you did that was wrong, right? So it started in your head. Maybe it was Lashon Hara. Maybe you spoke about something. Not you, because I know you're very careful. No, none of us. Okay. Never, 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 never any. Okay. I know. Okay. So right. So it we express it sometimes in our mouth and sometimes in our action, right? So we have all these levels that are expressed. So we want to counter that. So how do we counter that with a karban? Yismoch yadav alav keneged ha'maisa. One of the first steps you do with the sacrifice is you lean your hands on it. Okay? Before you bring the offering, you lean your hands on the head of the offering. V'yisvade b'fiv keneged ha'dibor. And then you say vidoy, right? On Yom Kippur, we say vidoy, we say ashamnu, baganu. So you also, in the bringing of an offering, you lean your hands, a physical action, you speak certain words as a way of countering the words that you may have said that were problematic. V'yisrof ba'esh, hakerav aklayos. And then there's a drama. You bring the offering onto the altar, and they burn it. And you see the innards of the animal being burnt. And they represent our thoughts and our desires. The hands, the feet, they represent our body that did these things. Right? And you take the blood, part of the whole ceremony, you take the blood from the animal, you sprinkle it. It's meant to represent our blood. And therefore a person thinks when we go ahead and bring an offering, when we see this animal, we all know, animals are the most similar to us in the world, right? A rock, they're a couple of levels away, but an animal is actually quite similar to us. And so the ach factor, remember we said, do I really want to go to a temple and I see these animals that are being, it's supposed to be an ach factor. It's supposed to feel uncomfortable because you're supposed to say, what, this is life. And you're supposed to think to yourself, yeah, you know what? Really, that should be me. Really, I'm the one that should be there. And so the fact that the animal looks like us and pulls on our heartstrings is exactly the point. It's supposed to have this sense of, that should really, it's supposed to be dramatic. It's supposed to be overwhelming. It's supposed to make us feel incredibly uncomfortable in order to dramatically impress upon us that when we sin, in many respects, we've in some ways relinquished our right to live. You know, life is a gift. You know, God gives you a car. You know, your friend gives you a brand new car and says, okay, here's the car. Here are the rules. When you break the rules, you got to give the car back, right? God gave us life and he gave us rules. We break the rules sometimes, right? So what the goal of Karbanos is really to impress upon us that really, we don't really deserve to be here. When we fail, then we really don't. And the animal and all that drama really is meant to bring that point across to us. Okay? And Virolai, and it is appropriate, sheyishbach damo, it's appropriate, we should be thinking as we watch the sacrifice being brought, that our blood should be spilt, v'yisrof gufo, and that our whole body should be burnt. I know this is very intense, I know it's uncomfortable to even hear these words, but, okay? Lulei chesed abore, the reason we're still here is because God is compassionate on us, God is kind. Shelakach mimenu tmura, God says, okay, I'll take something in exchange. You know, there'll be a replacement, so to speak. V'chiper karban hazeh, she'edamo tachas damo, nefesh tachas nefesh, that the soul of the blood of the animals instead of our blood, the soul is instead of our soul, etc., 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 right? So basically what he's saying over here is that the reaction, the natural reaction we have to karbanos is exactly the point. It's supposed to be unsettling. It's supposed to be uncomfortable. And we see that animal there. We're supposed to be thinking to ourselves, maybe, you know, am I really deserving? Am I doing everything I'm supposed to be doing in this life? Am I really living to my fullest? Okay, I know this it's not a 21st century way of thinking. We're much more positive and, you know, uplifting. And you could, but, you know, we sometimes have to be a little bit more dark and a little bit more realistic. And yeah, when we, you know, so basically the idea is that Karbanos is a symbolic representation of the self for punishment. Okay? Let's go to, yes.
So that's animals.
Good.
But what about grain and fruit?
Good, good. Good, 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 good. So you're right. That's a very good point. And he's only addressing over here the chatas offerings or anything related to chatas offerings. The sin offerings is a broader than the chatas, but basically only sin offerings. And that's a very, very fair point. Let's hold off on that. We'll see some other approaches which I think will address this. The Maharal, okay, we'll fast forward a few years. We turn to the second page. The Maharal in a book called Nesivot Ha'avoda, Nesivot Ha'avoda, describes sacrifice in a very simplistic fashion. And this really goes back to the very first Karbanos of Cain and Hevel. Cain and Abel, right? Cain is, what's his profession? What is his profession? Cain is a farmer. Hevel is a shepherd. Right? What do they bring as offerings? Cain brings stuff from the ground. Hevel brings a sheep. Why? So there are different approaches. The simplest approach is those things are important to them, right? They're basically bringing things that are valuable to them. It's basically like saying, I'm taking what's important to me and I'm bringing it to you, God, right? It's basically going, that's the simplest understanding. Karbanos are expensive. Karbanos are something, you know, an animal offering, if you could afford it, you know, it's something which is, it's not so cheap. It pushes people. It's basically, you know, a part of commerce back in the ancient world. And the very simplistic idea, the goal of Karbanos is that we are taking things that are important to us and bringing them to God. He says much more, but another factor. We're gonna build a whole bunch of different pieces and not pull them together, but I think it'll give us a broader understanding of Karbanos. Let's go a little bit further. This is one of my favorite approaches, and this is the approach of Rav Samson Raphael Hirsch. Rav Samson Raphael Hirsch takes great issue with the approach of Nachmanides. Ramban Nachmanides said what? He said that the goal of Karbanos is that we are sacrificing ourselves. And the English word sacrifice, it's basically a symbolic form of personal sacrifice. Really, I should be on the altar. There's a death, there is this intensity, and it's because I'm supposed to be there. Rav Hirsch says, wait a second, that makes no sense. Why? And let's read it together. I have it in English. It's the second source on the second page. It is most regrettable that we have no word. Sure, why not? Thank you. Thank you so much. Okay. That we have no word which really reproduces the idea which lies in the expression korban. Right? How do you translate the word korban? How would you translate the word korban? Sacrifice, right? If you look at the Rav Hirsch Chumash, okay, Samson Raphael Hirsch was, I hope over Pesach we're going to spend a lot of time talking about him. He was a fascinating, fascinating individual that changed the course of Jewish history in many respects. And he, amongst other things, he wrote a commentary on the Chumash and in German. Okay, he was in high German, in like a sophisticated German. And the word karban in the translation is translated as karban. He doesn't translate it. He says there's no English word that captures the meaning of korban, and you'll see why. He says the unfortunate use of the term sacrifice implies the giving of something up that is of value to oneself for the benefit of another, which is exactly what Nachmanides, Ramban, and Maharal just said, or of having to do without something of value. Ideas, he says, which are not only absent from the nature and idea of a korban, but are diametrically opposed to it. So we'll see in a second. Rav Hirsch basically completely rejects the idea that karban is about sacrifice, about taking ourselves and symbolic, you know, giving something of value, or that we ourselves are supposed to be there. He says that's wrong, and I'll show you his proofs. I'll give you one of the proofs that he says that proves it. Two things, right? Sacrifice. When does the sacrifice take place? Sacrifice is the most powerful part of the sacrifice when you kill the animal, right? You ever been to a slaughterhouse? No. Yeah, I refuse. I've been invited numerous times. I refuse. I like meat. I don't want to go. Okay, there you go. Well, slaughtering's a little more. She had to go. Got it. Okay. So sacrifice is, you know, so the killing of the animal, right? Who does that? Or let me say better. Who could do that in Jewish law? We know the avodah, the whole service is done by which part of the Jewish people? Who does the service in the temple? The priest, the Kohanim, right? The Kohen, right? The killing of the animal, you're actually, is not the job of the Kohen. Oftentimes the Kohen would do it. The Sheikh, right? And the Sheikh doesn't have to be a Kohen. The Sheikh, the slaughterer, could be a Yisrael, could be anyone, right? So Rav Hirsch says, wait a second. If you want to tell me that the essence, the core of Karbanos is the death, is the gory part, is the giving up, so when is that most pronounced? At the killing of the animal. And yet, that part could be done by anybody. It doesn't have to be done by a priest. So what does that tell you, he says? What it tells you is that the idea that a korban is all about sacrifice, is all about death, is all about giving up on oneself, must be a mistake. He says, that cannot be. Because if that was the truth, if that's the whole idea behind a korban, then the term that we use, then the law should be that the first part, the death, the killing of the animal, should be done by a priest. And yet it's not. So it must be that the killing part is not an integral part. So what then? Let's read the next paragraph. Korban, he says, from the word karev. Karev means closeness, means to approach, to come near, and so to get into a close relationship with somebody. This at once most positively gives the idea of the object and purpose of the process of Korban as the attainment of a higher sphere of life. The person desires that something of himself should come closer to God. That is what his Korban is. So says Rav Hirsch, the exact opposite of Nachmanides. But he takes the same idea. Everyone agrees that an animal, and we're still not talking about flower offerings, we'll get there. Everyone agrees that an animal is very similar to a human. Nachmanides says the whole idea of a korban is that we're supposed to be dead, we're supposed to be punished, and therefore the animal which represents me is being punished instead. Rav Hirsch says, no, korban from the word close. It's a positive. The idea is that the animal represents me. I want to be completely close to God. Have you ever, I don't know, stood in front of a majestic painting or stood on a cliff or overlooking like a beautiful, beautiful vista and like felt like the want to just be a part of it. Like just almost like lose yourself. Am I crazy? I'm crazy? No? Some of you? Okay. But right? you almost transcend your sense of self. You want to be completely close to it. So there's the idea, we want to be completely one with God. Now that's a very lofty idea. It's something which maybe we've experienced, maybe we haven't. It's a very, you know, very, very elevated experience. But basically like losing myself, I just want to be so connected to something else, like completely beyond myself, right? Like the picture, like the painting, God himself. Now, you know, I can't lose myself. I'm supposed to live on this earth, right? I'm supposed to be here. So what happens is we take an animal, and that animal, we bring it to the holiest of places, and the animal represents us. And we take it in a fire. The fire, the Torah tells us, is one that goes up to Hashem. The idea isn't gore. The idea isn't death. The idea isn't taking away of oneself. It's basically saying, I want to be close to this godly fire. I'll get burnt if I come too close to God. Right? There's this very famous story in the Talmud in Chagiga about these four people who went to what's known as the Pardes. This very, very lofty, mystical experience of union with God. And most of them came out damaged. Some of them died in the process. Some of them lost their minds in the process. Some of them, you know, it's very hard to come close to God, right? So the idea is that the korban, the animal, represents us clinging to God in the loftiest, most poetic, most beautiful fashion. Okay? It's diametrically opposed to Nachman. Nachman, he says, we're killing ourselves. We're hurting ourselves. The animal represents us. We're supposed to be punished. Rav Hirsch says, no, I'm trying to come as close to Pa as possible. I can't do it. I'm limited. I'm in this physical body, but I want it. Or I want to want it. I want to feel that. What do? I take an animal to represent me in the holiest of places, a place that I can't be, and bring it up to God. Yes?
That's your dvar for the campaign.
That's my dvar for the campaign. Give up yourself. What do you mean?
It's
about coming close to God. Absolutely. There we go. That was the appeal just now. No, just kidding.
What is the beginning of a vegetarian?
Oh, we're going to get to vegetarianism in a moment. Yes, yes, yes. I think I got to go a little faster. But yes, we're going to get to vegetarianism in a moment because this is an important part of this whole discussion. So we're going to get there. One more idea, and that is from Rabbi Sachs, who always has a beautiful take on such ideas. Let's see what he says. He says, children know how dependent they are on their parents. They know that when they give their parents a present, it is usually only a token gesture. One of my, I don't have so many childhood memories. I don't know. You could psychoanalyze me if you want. But I don't know. My memory is like, Baruch Hashem, thank God. I had a wonderful upbringing. But one distinct memory I have is one day when I woke up, the fact that my parents were giving me so much. So I took all my money. I was like five. I took all my money, which was, I live in Canada, loonies and toonies, okay? Like basically a bunch of change. And I basically gave it to my mother. I said, here you go. It's like $6, right? And it was very cute. And it's also pathetic because, you know, when you compute tuition, you know, or food for one meal, then it's a joke, right? But it's a token gesture. It's basically a way of saying, like, I felt guilty. I felt like overwhelmed. Like, oh my gosh, you're giving me all this stuff. I wanted to give back, right? It is so when children give a gift to their parents, even as we grow older, we get, you know, maybe you give a gift to your parents. What can you possibly do to repay your parents for giving you life? Nothing. Anything you do is either insulting or more generously, we see it as a token of appreciation. It's a gesture. It is a supremely risky move on the part of parents to genuinely empower a child to give them something of real worth. It is the ultimate act of humility, and it confers on the child a dignity and self-worth like no other. So here he says something profound. He says, now, we could take that attitude as a parent to a child and say, okay, when a child gives me something like, that's a repayment for me waking up middle of the night, for wiping those diapers, for paying for your tuition, for right? So we could look at it that way. Or as we get, you know, hopefully more mature, we could say, like, no, I'm going to step back and say whatever this child, I'm making space for the child to give me something and to really value it, right? It's the ultimate act of humility, and it confers on the child a dignity. When we're able to really take from a child, whether that's materially, whether that's intellectually, take advice from a child, that takes a lot of self-esteem, to be able to say, my child's going to tell me what to do. Guess what? They have brains too, right? And then they may see something that we don't see, but it takes a certain humility to be able to do so, to really value what they're giving. So he says, for God to allow such a gesture is a supreme act of self-limitation. This is a big idea in Rabbi Sachs's thinking. He says that the whole notion of whichever approach you take of karbanos, but certainly the last two, it's a gift from man to God. We are giving something that God says, oh, this is wonderful. Just to appreciate the fact that God does that. And God says, I want something from you. We're not talking about a parent to a child. We're talking about God, the creator of the world, who is able to say, I want something from you. So whichever approach you take for karbanos, Rabbi Sachs is giving a more global point, and that is that when we're giving these karbanos, it's an act of love on our part, but it's also the fact that God accepts it from us is the greatest act of love. God says, you're meaningful. Your little deed, your little mitzvah, your little this is something which is important to me. Okay, so that's, I think, just an overarching point, overarching view of karbanos. So again, just to quickly summarize, we have Maimonides, who says that in some way, karbanos was meant to counter the negative and faulty ideology of the time. We have Nachmanides, who says an animal is a representation of us. We, when sinning, we've lost our right to live. The animal reminds us of it as it goes through its traumatic experience. We have the Maharal, who says that animals are expensive. We're supposed to give what's something of value. We give a big donation, so to speak. It shows that it's valuable. It shows that we care. And we have Rav Hirsch, who says beautifully that no, it's the exact opposite. The animal does represent us, but it's me trying to come so incredibly close to God. It's almost this mystical union. And Rav Sachs' is more general idea to recognize the fact that there's even an institution of karbanos, that God says, I want this from you. And that's true not only for karbanos. It's true for us studying Torah, right? This is God says, this is meaningful to me. Why? God needs us? You know? No, but God created a world where he, so to speak, does need us, where he wants things from us. And therefore, this is the ultimate act of love on God's part that he invites us to give to him. God says, I need something from you. I want something from you. And that is an act of love on God's part. But now we're going to do is fast forward. Because the question that arises is, what about nowadays? Or, God willing, Bekarov, and we believe in the Messianic era, we believe in a rebuilding of the temple. In that temple, will there be sacrifices? Will we bring offerings? Will there be an altar, right? So before we even talk about that, let's quickly summarize some views about mitzvos in the future. Okay, so there's a Gemara in Nida. If we look towards the bottom page, mitzvos in the Messianic era. There's a Gemara in Masechet Nida, which says that mitzvos, that the commandments, will be nullified la'asid lavo in the future. Actually, the way that one of the Gemara says it is that all mitzvos, and all, one of the Gemara says that all holidays will be nullified except for one holiday. You know which one that is? Purim. Isn't that amazing? If you had to pick which holiday is the most important holiday, you probably wouldn't pick Purim. You'd say like Yom Kippur, Pesach, something, right? So it's not for today, but it's something to think about, right? That of all holidays, it's wild, right? There's a lot of beautiful thought on this, but it's a wild idea. The only holiday that's not going to be annulled is Purim, okay? Unfortunately, we can't address that today, but something as we get ready for Purim to think about. It's their high holiday. Very good. Very good. So we have this one Gemara that says that all mitzvos will be nullified in the future. We have other Gemaras, other Talmudic passages, which say the opposite, which say that mitzvos, all the mitzvos will remain standing in the future. Nothing will change. And this is actually how Maimonides codifies it. Maimonides takes the second view. Maimonides rules that no mitzvos will ever change. The mitzvos are a constant. The mitzvos are a constant. But there's a big debate among the classical commentators whether in the Messianic era there is the possibility of a change in mitzvos. Maimonides says it will remain the same based on some Talmudic passages. There are others like Rav Albo, another great thinker, author of Sefer Yikarim, who says, no, mitzvos will possibly change. There is a view which kind of merges these two ideas together. You know, we talk about Mashiach, we talk about Olam Haba, the world to come. But, you know, there's a lot of confusion. We don't spend a lot of time. Actually, I'm thinking, you'll let me know what you think, not right now, but I'm thinking that after this year, maybe for next year, we'll spend some time maybe during this class really talking about the Messianic era, resurrection of the dead, you know, things of that nature. It's a little more mystical, but there's some fascinating stuff, which, you know, just to clarify what is Jewish thought on these ideas, which are not so well known. So maybe we'll do that. You can let me know offline if that's a good idea. But there is an approach and an understanding that the Messianic era isn't a static era. There are stages. There is stage one, when there's a rebuilding of the temple. And then there is a stage two, when things perhaps become more elevated. And a stage three, and a stage four, and things start to shift in a more spiritual fashion in a way that I cannot do justice in describing, because we can't conceptualize, because it's so foreign to us. But the point is that there are stages in the Messianic era, and there are some who say that, like this. In the first stage of the Messianic era, mitzvos will remain the same, meaning rebuilding the temple, sacrifices. But it might be that as time progresses, things will become more and more elevated, will become more, where we don't believe we're static in life. Things are, we're constantly in flux, and that's true spiritually as well. As the world becomes more elevated, there'll be less and less physical world, there'll be more and more spiritual world. And therefore, what could be is that maybe at the first stage, all the mitzvos will remain the same, and then as time goes on, things will shift. And that could be, if you look at the next or the last source on the second page, Rav Kook has a statement, and this is how some understand in the context of what I just said. He writes, in the future, the abundance of knowledge will spread to and penetrate even animals. And this is for you. That even animals will have knowledge of God. Knowledge of God, right? Animals, you may have an animal, you may like animals, you may not like animals, but in the future, says Rav Kook, even animals will be enlightened in a godly fashion. And the sacrifices, which will then be from grain, will be as pleasing to God as in the days of old and yesteryear when there were animal sacrifices. So Rav Kook writes that in the future, and maybe it doesn't mean the first stage, but maybe at a later stage, there will be such an abundance of spiritual knowledge, there'll be such an abundance that even the animals will be so elevated, they'll be inappropriate to sacrifice them. Meaning right now, animals, there's a clear hierarchy, and there's us. And there's animals, and animals don't have an elevated soul. But perhaps in the future, as the world shifts, and I don't even know what these words mean practically, but as the world becomes more and more elevated, animals will be so elevated that it would be inappropriate to sacrifice them. And therefore, says Rav Kook, according to one approach, there will just be this idea of only bringing only bringing grain offerings and not animal offerings. Okay? That's one approach. Again, I want to be very clear. There are those who are adamant about the fact that in the Messianic era, there will be sacrifices. There are those who say that there will be sacrifices, but maybe at a later stage of the Messianic era, there will not be sacrifices. That's one, another way of looking at it. If you go to the third page, and you can now look under Sefer Ikarim, this is just more background knowledge about this question of will mitzvos change. So, we're running out of time, but we'll try to go through this quickly. You can read it over in your own time as well. So Rav Albo, who is a major thinker in the 15th century, takes issue with Maimonides, who says that mitzvos will never change. He writes like this: moreover, assuming that the biblical expressions have the meaning he gives to them, that does not prove the Torah will never be repealed or changed. The Bible, you know, let's skip that paragraph. Let's skip to the next paragraph. It is clear, therefore, that a thing which the worshippers of God were in a habit of doing in God's honor, and which was absolutely permitted in the time of Moses at the Sinai of Revelation, was forbidden in the plains of Moab, according to the opinions of the rabbis. So far as certain marriages of affinities are concerned, which were permitted to the Noahites, we see them expressly forbidden in the Bible. All this shows that divine law did change, now permitting, now forbidding, in accordance with the times. This was the situation in the times of Adam and Noah and Avram until Moshe came. There has been no change since his day. So what is he talking about? What is he saying over here? Rav Albo points out, in the times of Adam and Noah, did he eat meat? No. Adam and Chava were told, you must only eat herbs and fruit, etc. Right? Later on, they're allowed to. What's that all about? Right? Does that mean that we are less moral than Adam was? Maybe. Right? We also know that our forefathers, you know, Jacob, Yaakov, married two sisters, right? Permitted to him? Well, to him, maybe, it was before the Torah, right? Permitted to us? No, right? So was Yaakov less moral than we were? I'm not going to go there, right? No, not a chance, right? Yaakov Avinu, he was the great, you know, the greatest of the great. So what does this mean? What that means is that there is a possibility of change. There were changes in the, based on a myriad of factors, cultural, and then, who knows, that changed what was considered moral at different times. In the times of Adam and Chava, eating meat was immoral. Now, eating meat is fine. In the times of Yaakov, marrying to this form of what we would call incestuous relationship was not considered immoral, and now it is, right? So now, we don't have the ability. Here's a technical thing. We don't have the ability, and nobody has the ability, to change the laws of the Torah. Until we have someone of the level of Moshe, and we have a number of things that could prove that. So when, yes, go ahead.
But at that time, the Torah was not given to us.
That's true. But we do believe, that's an excellent point. But we do believe that God communicated to Adam and Adam, right? God spoke to Adam and Eve. So it's true they didn't have the Torah. But if I were to ask you, is it more, but God was speaking to them. God could have told them, you know, you guys could eat meat, just like later on. Or he could have, God spoke to Yaakov. He could have said, Yaakov, this whole sister thing, bad idea. Don't do it, right? God spoke to Yaakov, and yet he didn't stop him. And yet Yaakov is seen as the greatest of the greats. So clearly, it's true they didn't have the Torah, and that's precisely his point. The Torah was given for this era, but there were clearly before the Torah, there was a different standard of morality, right? So what that tells you, says Rav Albo, is at least philosophically, you could make an argument that in theory, there are different times and eras where different mitzvos would be true. Now, there is a system for how the Torah could change. And until you match that system, like finding a prophet on par with Moshe, where everyone can ascertain their credibility, etc., 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 then we can start talking about mitzvot's change. Now, why is this such a dangerous view? Why do people not talk about this view? Because if you don't read very carefully, you could say, hey, there's this prophet who came along. His name was Jesus. And he said that the laws of the Torah don't apply anymore. Or, fast forward, there is this guy who came along. This prophet who came along, his name was Shabtai Tzvi. And he said that we don't have to worry about certain laws, right? Now, they could quote Rav Albo and say, look, the laws change. Now, if you read the whole passage, he makes quite a compelling argument that you can't just flick your fingers and say, oh, he's a great person, we could change it. The threshold is virtually impossible to reach, certainly as we've seen it until now. So this is theoretical and perhaps true for the Messianic era, but not true right now. So there is this philosophical debate, and this is just the background to address the question, of whether or not there is ever going to be a change in the mitzvos. Will we have sacrifice in the future? Really revolves around this debate. According to Maimonides, the mitzvos are a constant. Whatever the mitzvos were and now are going to be in the Messianic era. There are those who argue and say, no, mitzvos can possibly change. The threshold, how to do so, is complicated. And within that approach, there are some who say that karbanos, sacrifice offerings, will not be at some point in the future. So those are the two. So let's just quickly review and call it a day. The purpose, if someone's to ask you, why does Judaism endorse sacrifice or offerings or karbanot? We have Rambam who says, in some way, to wean us away from idolatry. We have the Maharal who says that it's a great gift. We have Ramban who says that we are sacrificing it to stand in for our own personal deserved suffering. We have Rav Samson Rafael Hirsch who says, no, it's from the word karev. It's not sacrifice. That's a bad translation. Karev, karban is from karev, coming close. It's a closeness. It's a stand in for our desire to be consumed in the all-embracing, passionate fire of God. And we have Rabbi Sachs who points out that from God's perspective, it's an act of humility, empowerment, and love that God says, I want something from you. And then we have this question, will we have sacrifice in the future? It's a debate among two classical commentators and more, but Rambam, Maimonides, says the mitzvos are immutable. Whatever the mitzvos were, will always be. And we have this approach of Rav Albo who says that it could possibly change when certain very specific conditions are met, and therefore there's at least the possibility that at the end of days, certain practices will be no longer, and possibly within that, sacrifice will also be annulled. There's a longer discussion, which we just touched upon, about the whole question of vegetarianism. We can't get into it today. Maybe we'll try to find an excuse to connect it to one of the parshios. And now, hopefully, we have a bit of a better, broader understanding of karbanos. I hope we all hesitate now before we use the translation of sacrifices, because I don't think that, to Rav Hirsch's point, that's not the best, maybe, offering, but even that doesn't capture it. A karban is a karban is a karban. That's the word we'll use, because at least according to Rav Hirsch, it's about us wanting to be so close to God that we bring a stand-in, like, we call it avatar. You know, if you play, like, video games, you have this avatar that's on the screen. So basically, it's like the animal's our avatar. It's basically our representative coming close to God. We can't do it on our own, but we want, nafshi cholat avasecha. I am like, I'm so longing and yearning for your love. I want to be consumed by you. And that's to me the one that stands out the most, and the most compelling approach of what offerings, what karbanos really are, is it's an expression of what we desire, or at least what we hopefully want to want. If we can't connect to that, we should at least want to have that type of feeling. We're just like when we stand in front of a majestic painting or beautiful music or a hilltop, and we just feel this yearning of transcendence. That's the idea of sacrifice. Really represents this notion of wanting to transcend ourselves and our connection to God, which even if we can't touch and feel, is something we should strive to be able to one day at least begin to envision.